Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's Baby Friday, joined by two athletes, Justin Cuthbert, going for the long distance record at the next Olympic Games.
I'm just gonna be trying to hit an over.
And then me washed up the other side. Biggest fan, though. I'll be your number one fan. Next Friday, we've decided we'll be the beep test, everybody. Next Friday.
It's a short turnaround.
Justin has exactly 8 days to prepare. Ugh. I wish you well.
It will be okay.
You know someone that would follow up and would never, ever waver from a challenge?
Okay, but the text line, I'm not wavering from the challenge. We're just talking about it. I'm doing it. I'm doing the beep test.
All right, you sound sensitive. John Morosi, MLB Network Insider, joins us this morning. John, what a night in the city of Toronto. I'm sure you enjoyed watching from afar, but man, what's it feel like to have this storyline kind of finally hitting an end, at least for now?
Well, good morning, Ailish and Justin. It's certainly one chapter of it. It's certainly one more big home run to go for Aaron Judge. But I think the weight of the last week and the weight on his shoulders during that time were becoming stories unto themselves. Mm-hmm. And so you could see the relief on Aaron Judge's face last night. Certainly the embrace of his teammates out of the dugout, that's going to be something that we always remember, and having his mom there, Patty, next to Roger Maris Jr. It was a great baseball moment, one that I think we're always going to remember, because however many home runs he winds up with, 61 is a special number in baseball and always has been, certainly for the last 61 years. And so as a result, I think last night's game and the moment, and I think the thing that impresses me the most about Aaron over the last week is that even as the pressure mounted and the weight continued, he never deviated from his approach. He was not going outside the zone. You saw all the walks that he had in the game on Tuesday. He's been patient. He's been focused. And I think last night was just a beautiful capstone on what's been an extraordinary season.
What did you feel watching it, John? I mean, someone so connected to the game, so in tune with the importance and magnitude of this moment, when the ball left the bat of Aaron Judge, what did it mean to you?
Well, it's a great question. And certainly for me, I was there over the weekend at Yankee Stadium, so I experienced the home crowd's emotion and the sort of the angst in every moment and that end of it. And then I think to see it, to see him achieve it last night, I was thrilled for him, for the Yankees, for the game itself, for a lot of fans, because there has been, I think, this complexity and the disillusionment that followed 98. And I think now that it's in the hands of someone who is really universally respected, and it's now, I think, authentically his, and now his and Roger Maris's together at 61. You could tell the relief and I think the joy on the faces of certainly the Maris family in the case of Roger Maris Jr. yesterday, and I had spoken with Kevin Maris, one of Roger's other sons, over the weekend at Yankee Stadium about it, and I think the way in which the Maris family is embracing Aaron Judge and vice versa, I think just speaks to the connectedness of the sport, certainly of the New York Yankees. And I think just it's sort of a cleansing moment for the game. It really is. It's a positive one that I think we've been hoping to have for a long time. And you really can just feel great about this moment. This is it's someone who represents the game so well, and Aaron has been so classy in all of my conversations with him over the years, and with everybody's conversations with him, because he's just that consistently himself and so authentic and very gracious and everything that you hope to have in a superstar. So, and oh, by the way, he's doing this, Justin, against the backdrop of his contract year. So that'll be decided November, December, January. But and oh, by the way, not only is there still one more home run to get to have the record be his and his alone, but the Triple Crown is in play. And with a week's worth of games left, he has the lead in all three categories, and he'd be the first Yankee to win Triple Crowns as Mickey Mantle. So all these names that we're mentioning here, Maris and Mantle, and thinking about this, the historic nature of what he did last night is special. And I'm also, in a way, I realized that the Jays lost the ball game and wanted to win it and to clinch a spot last night. But it's unique that Rogers Center is always going to be part of baseball history in this way. This is going to be a place and a time that we're always going to remember that it happened at Rogers Center. And I think the Jays fans were just so gracious in the moment. And I think it was just a great time for baseball all the way around.
John, how is it even possible that Aaron Judge could be wearing a different jersey next year? I mean, the Yankees I grew up on, the Yankees that I used to know, would never let a player of his caliber, after what he did this year, after what he means to the franchise currently, they would never, ever in a million years let him go. How is it even possible that this is a discussion and a distinct possibility?
Well, it's a great question, Justin, because to me, there's still that chance in the wintertime that he would leave. Now, what impact does this achievement have on the decision? I happen to think that having had this season from both sides of the equation, there's a little greater trust and a little greater understanding of what mutually can be done in the future between Judge and the Yankees. Now, I realize that 12 months ago, none of the three of us would have thought that there was much of a chance of Freddie Freeman leaving Atlanta, especially if they went on to win the World Series as they did, and yet that happened. I think in a way, the way that things unfolded with Freeman was a really good reminder to everybody, and at least among the prominent free agents, about the need to kind of not let pride or a lack of communication get in the way of where you want to be. And I think from Aaron's perspective, he just fits this organization so well. And I think it's important for both him and the organization to look at it that way. Let's take, for example, just theoretically, let's say that he signs with the Mets. How different would his day-to-day life be, and just the tension of crossing town and the pressure of a new contract and leaving the Yankees? That just sounds, at least to me, really complicated, and really something that would be maybe unnecessarily complicated in one's life. Whereas the Yankees fans adore him. He has achieved something that is truly legendary and an all-time moment for the franchise. I would think that there'd be tremendous incentive for him to stay. Now, certainly we've learned that in sports, all free agent negotiations tend to take on a life of their own, but I really believe that the way in which he has grown closer to the organization and vice versa over the course of the year, whatever the numbers end up being, I think will allow there to be a coming together of the parties and the right outcome, to be honest with you, which is that he belongs in New York, he belongs in pinstripes.
If it's not New York, a lot of speculation is that he'd be a guy that wants to go closer to home, back to the West Coast, and maybe be a part of a franchise over there. Is that where you might see a team that really needs that face to join? Is that something that could be a potential in your eyes? And has there ever been a better bet on yourself season in baseball history for a guy to go all in, have this type of year, and then be waiting for the major payday?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Alicia. I can't recall in any sport, to be honest with you, a better walk year where you enter free agency in this fashion and you're the most in demand person in the whole sport. It's a great point. I do think that with respect to the West Coast, I think the team that probably stands out to me and in the minds of a lot of people in the industry would be the Giants, because the Giants they pursued Harper years ago, didn't get him. They just had Buster Posey retire. The entire group of their championship winning core of Posey and Belt and Crawford, they're all getting older, and so there's this natural turnover in the roster. And I think that's where I'm sure the Giants with a relatively new president of baseball operations at Farhan Zaidi and ownership wanting to maybe make a big splash given all the success of the Dodgers down the coast. That's the one that I could see, and I'm sure they will make a bid. But it's also true that Aaron has spent now so much time in New York that's also home for him. I do think that sometimes all of us in sports covering it and looking at free agency, like the hometown can be a sway for some people and they want to play there, but also it invites a certain level of complexity where when you play that close to home, you get more ticket requests from friends and family and you don't quite have that same separation in life. We see it all the time with prominent hockey free agents from the Toronto area. It's not always the slam dunk, John Tavares aside, of course, to come back home. So I do think that in the case of Judge, the Giants can and probably will make a really compelling pitch. But I think the Yankees have learned from what he's done this year that here is someone who can answer the bell, who can stand up to the pressure of New York. And let's be honest, too, Ailish, you look at the way the Yankees have played the last couple months, he's been the mainstay. He's not just one great bat in a collection of incredible offensive players. For the last couple months, he's carried the team. And I think that you have to ask yourself, if you're the Yankees, how does my lineup look without him? And if you don't like the answer based on the health track record of some other veteran players there, I think that further underscores the need to sign him and to bring him back long term.
You've been watching Aaron Judge's season closer than us, I assume. So this might not be a surprise to you, but I just came away just marveling at his composure, his plate discipline, everything that all the context of this chase and how he just performed at the plate with, you know, his discipline, as I mentioned, and just being within himself at all times. It was an incredible series, although he just finished it 2-for-8 with that one home run and a couple RBIs and a bunch of runs scored. What do you make of how how he handled the series and also how the Jays handled the series? I mean, a lot of noise from some certain pundits south of the border criticizing the Blue Jays for their approach. But really, I think they executed really, really well throughout, pretty much across the board, giving Aaron Judge, you know, very little, but not completely giving into him. And really, in the end, Aaron Judge just figured out a puzzle and finally had one pitch to hit and did hit it. But overall, the Blue Jays did a pretty good job managing him, despite what was a really good series, I thought, from Judge overall.
Well, that's really well said. And when you consider the approach that the Jays took to him, it's exactly what you would expect from a team that's battling to clinch a playoff spot. I think on both sides of it, the best you can say is that neither of them went outside of what the game asked of them. And I think when you discuss baseball strategy, that's one of the best things you can say about a team or a player, is that they stuck to their approach and to what the game and the circumstances dictated. For the Jays, they looked at this and said, we can't let him beat us because he will. And so if that means walking him, we're going to walk him. That's exactly how you would expect them to approach things. And on Judge's side of things, you really admire his patience and his steadiness and steadfastness to remain within the strike zone and not chase, and take his walks when it was important. And I think you saw, I think it was really telling, he was all about taking his walks, scoring runs to help the Yankees win the division. And I love that he was rewarded for that eventually, that as he took his walks, as the Yankees were able to score runs, that then he was rewarded with a pitch in the strike zone from a lefty that he was able to do damage on, and he crushed it. And I think that just tells you how dialed in he's been. I covered a game of his about a month ago in Anaheim where he got probably one pitch to hit, and he hit it out to the rock pile in center field. So that's the amazing thing, and that's why the all-time greats in this sport or any sport are just different. Their mind works differently, their body works differently, and his ability to quiet the noise is both extraordinarily impressive and, for me, from having known him a bit over the years, not surprising. This is how he is. This is why he's so great. He's able to turn off the distractions and the noise around him and just focus on on that one, you could call it in baseball a keyhole spot, that one spot, one pitch, one spot, and know that if it's in that zone, he's going to crush it. And last night he did. And it was an all-time baseball moment that he arrived at the right way. And that's the best part of this. He arrived at this entire achievement the right way. And now he's got another three games at home and another handful on the road to try to get to 62. And it really does set a nice platform for him to play the Orioles at home, the same team against whom Derek Jeter had his memorable final game at Yankee Stadium walk-off 8 years ago. The Baltimore Orioles now come back to Yankee Stadium, and it's potentially against that team, the team of Cal Ripken, that Judge could stand alone now in American League history.
So you call it an all-time baseball moment. So was the heartbreaking end to where that ball landed, and the Blue Jays fan who had a $1 million lottery ticket slip from his hand into the bullpen. What did you just make of the shenanigans of that event? And is it maybe a silver lining that the ball did find its way back to Aaron Judge and then to his mom after the post game?
Yes. No, that's well said, Ailish. I think this, a couple things. Number one, I was watching the coverage last night on MLB Network after the game was over, and the StatCast data on that home run was the hardest hit home run by Aaron Judge all season long. So this is basically like saying if a puck goes into the crowd and it's off of Shea Weber in his prime, can you catch it? And that's what that was. So I realized it was 300 plus feet away, but that was, none of that would be considered a routine play. That was not a routine play.
So You're being nice, John.
I'm going to afford a lot of grace to that Jays fan. I realized the Jays fan was seated in the right spot, was wearing a glove, and so therefore was well situated to make the play. But that was not what I would call a routine play. That was not. He, based on the replay, had to lean over the railing, and I'm a little wary of that. I don't know. Maybe that's just because I've got three kids and I'm always looking around for danger and peril and trying to protect them from things like that. But I would say there's a railing and the hardest hit home run that Aaron Judge had hit all season long. I'm going to give that fan a lot of grace on that one. That is a tough play to make. So he should not feel badly at all. And good on Matt Bushman and Jordan Romano for helping Judge get the ball. I think all's well that ends well. That ball belongs, from where I sit, to the Judge family. They've got it now. I think that's pretty special. And so I'm totally okay, as much as I would have, would have been great for the Jays fan to get it. I'm totally okay with how things wound up, and I will not utter a word of criticism about his play, because I think he did the best job he could. And the final note I wanted to mention on Judge and why his season is so amazing. Think about this. He's on pace to win the Triple Crown, and no one who has ever won a Triple Crown has hit more than 60 home runs. In fact, the most home runs ever hit by a Triple Crown winner was Mantle at 52. So we are talking about, by any measure, one of the great seasons in baseball history. So this is pretty remarkable that it all reached a pretty unique apex there in the great city of Toronto. Right beside that, you're celebrating the 72 Summit Series medalist there, right in the next door building. So pretty special night downtown.
Yeah, you're right. I think it ended the way it should have, although there is another chapter, as you mentioned. It might not have the same ending, but, you know, maybe there'll be that fan story in New York, which is probably where the fan story should be. We're just happy that no one jumped into the bullpen, because there wasn't really any movement. Like, I don't think they knew how to react, the Blue Jays bullpen, immediately. And I thought there might be a fan jumping from the first level into the bullpen to try and get that ball. And thankfully, that didn't happen. I want to ask you about Mitch White. And more specifically, can you, as an organization, just ruin a pitcher? Like, if you run out someone over and over again when he's in over his head and force him to eat it start after start, do you run the risk of, like, never getting the potential out of that player because they've been spoiled to a certain extent? Like, we see this in hockey, and you're a hockey guy, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you rush a prospect and they never get to that point because they've been put in a position that they can't handle, Are we maybe seeing something like that in baseball? Can that happen in baseball? Or are we seeing it with Mitch White right now?
Yeah, it certainly can happen, and I've seen it happen before where sometimes a player's development never quite catches up if they're put into a situation before they're really ready for it. I think in the case of White, he has been he's not a kid. While he's relatively young in the major leagues, he's in his 20s. He's got a lot of experience in the minor leagues, and I personally think that he is relatively close in terms of his pitch making ability to perhaps who he is going to be. And I think the Jays' question on this has to be, is he a small adjustment away from being a reliable starter for us or a reliable middle innings pitcher during the postseason? Or is this something he's going to have to work on in the offseason before we really trust him in a playoff spot? I think that when you consider Berríos has to start a game in the postseason for the Jays to be able to get where they need to go. I think that to me is how I look at this playoff rotation. It's four deep if you've got a productive Berríos, and if not, then you've got Stripling obviously as your three potentially, and White is your number five starter / bulk guy, middle innings guy when you get into a playoff scenario. And I would say, Justin, that a great many teams in baseball have a fifth starter whose ERA is up in the fives and who they don't know if they're going to get through four innings in a given night, which was the case for White last night. I think this is normal for me to have questions about your fifth starter. Where the Jays can't have questions is about Berríos. He's the guy that I think is the determining factor between the Jays having a really successful playoff run and not. Because a lot of teams will take their fifth starter, and either he's not on the roster at all or he's a bulk guy. But I think you're right that he has not quite shown the ability to make huge pitches against the teams like the Yankees in a big spot. And by the way, a lot of pitchers who are in the first couple of years of their career struggle with that, especially against a team like the Yankees. I think in White's case, he hasn't quite had the command that they would have expected of him, and they need a little bit more out of that spot if they really want to be able to keep going deeper into the playoffs. And because there's going to be a time, and we see it often now, Justin, the length of starts in the playoffs is getting shorter and shorter every year. And so whoever you're running out there as the first person out of the pen, that can sometimes happen in the fourth, fifth inning nowadays. And so that role is the separating role. That role is one that the Houston Astros will have an extraordinary abundance of pitching, and the Jays simply don't. And that's why for the Jays, they're going to enter the playoffs having to probably outslug teams to win, because the middle part of their pen is not as good as what you see with Houston, who I think is the gold standard right now in the American League. So you're right on about it, about the concern concerning Mitch White, but I think in many ways he is already close. He's not fully there, but he's already close to being the pitcher that he's likely going to be for the next couple of years in his major league career.
John, enjoy the 62 watch now. Continues on the narratives will never end. Appreciate you joining us this morning. We'll chat with you soon. Playoff baseball just around the corner.
Can't wait. Hey, listen, Justin, thanks for the call today, and have a great weekend coming up.
You too. Thanks, John. John Morosi, MLB Network Insider. Your part one of the chapter is closed, and now 62 watch, and I'm sure it'll be a much different situation in the Yankees stands. I think it happens the next three games against Orioles at home. Best of luck to all of you in attendance. Don't drop that ball.
No, don't drop that ball. And extend if you need to. Frankie Lasagna will be thinking about how he short-armed that one.
John's such a good guy. He didn't want to critique the fan who dropped the ball. But
John said
it perfectly.
We're
not that good of people. We can do it.
No, of course. John said it perfectly, though. Like what it means, like the purity of this chase.
Yeah.
How Judge has done it the right way. And you can just see the way he approached at bat after at bat in the series versus the Jays. Like, this guy is fundamentally sound, does it the right way, was never pressing. Really, really impressive what we saw from Aaron Judge. And I think to put a bow on the story that was this series, I think it ended almost perfectly.
And you mentioned the purity of this race to this accomplishment. It's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
Roger Maris Jr. obviously was asked a lot about this journey and about last night after being in attendance for the last 2 weeks of games, waiting for last night's moment. He talked about Aaron Judge's accomplishment and the era that it's in right now.
I think it means a lot for a lot of people, you know, that he's clean, he's a Yankee, he plays the game the right way. And, you know, I think it gives people a chance to look at somebody who, you know, should be revered for hitting 62 home runs and not just as a guy who did it in the American League. He should be revered for, you know, being the actual single season home run champ. I mean, that's really who he is if he hits 62. And I think that's what needs to happen. I think baseball needs to look at the records, and I think baseball should do something.
So it's something to chew on and that he poses, and I'm sure there's a lot of baseball fans out there thinking the same thing right now, is will they ever edit the history books to reflect the steroid era versus the quote clean era that we're in? Roger Maris Jr. thinks that whatever Aaron Judge does next with the 62 home runs will be the record, and it should be the record regardless of the Bonds has 73 home runs in 2001. Like, there's, you know, there's still things that do sit in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
This is still kind of an asterisk type situation, but is that going to be something moving forward where that is actually the case? And is that what baseball fans want? If you're listening, 590-590, maybe you were around during that era and you watched those players. Like, what is your perspective on how they move forward with tainted history?
I don't know. I mean, like, do you want to erase the names of the players that used steroids, we believe, to hit more home runs than Roger Maris and Aaron Judge? Like, do we just, they don't exist? Pretend that they don't exist? History is history. You can't erase every bit. You can't erase the bad things from history. History is history. What happened, happened. You nailed it. Asterisks. I'm an asterisk guy. We shouldn't just use it for everything, but when it's applicable, it's applicable.
You're, and
it's
an applicable. Asterisk guy.
I'm an asterisk guy. Big asterisk guy.
I get you a use shirt that says, I'm an asterisk guy.
Use the asterisk when you need to use the asterisk. And in this case, we know. You don't have to change anything because we know. We know that Aaron Judge, if he hits another home run, has had the greatest home run hitting season for a player that did it the right way. Did he hit the most home runs in the history of baseball in a single season? No. There are guys that topped him. But they did it illegally, and for that reason, we should revere and respect what Judge did more. But that doesn't mean, like, we can just, like, what is it, Men in Black, where they just hold up that pen and you just forget? Like, you can't forget. It happened. It happened.
Here's a couple texts in about this. I knew this is going to be a spicy topic, and it's not going away because Aaron Judge is going to hit number 62 in the next 3 days, and then this will have lasting impact on how we view these records. Zach from Etobicoke. Bonds never tested positive under MLB testing. He has a record. No way for MLB to remove him. Next text. If they were records illegally obtained, they would not be in the record book.
Well, we do have admissions, right? From, again, I don't know the Messi. Whole, I don't know the whole timeline
here. Big asterisk guy.
But we know. We know. And it's fine. We know, and we can just, you just make your own decisions on who you consider the home run king.
Certainly,
and if Aaron Judge hits another one, the vast majority of people are going to consider him the greatest home run hitter in a single season, and justifiably so.
Chew on that, folks.
Yum, yum, yum.
Stick a break. Going to continue with our power show of guests. Nate Burleson.
Huge show.
And then the guy you know and love at 8 o'clock, Elliot Friedman. Back from his gallivanting all summer long, going to join us back in the grind.
Gallivanting, I think he was putting in work predominantly. I don't want to put that on him.
We'll ask him. But next, after the break, is Nate Burleson. Thursday Night Football's back, baby. Let's set up tonight's game. and the weekend ahead. That's next on the Fan Morning Show with Big Asterix Guy, Big Runner, Justin Cuthbert, and Ailish Farfar.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. 1 week and 1 day away from Justin Cuthbert running the beep test. He's starting to get shaken in his boots a bit over there.
It's a tight turnaround.
It is a tight turnaround. But if you want to continue with wagers, please send in your Wake and Rake anchor submissions. You have about another 40 minutes. We'll accept them. Today's major game, pretty much the only game in terms of relevancy in your viewing, unless you're watching Orioles and Red Sox, which has some Blue Jays implications, would be Colts and Broncos tonight, Thursday Night Football at 8 p.m. Send in your Wake and Rake submissions if you want to be a part of our three-leg parlay, which has hit twice this week. You get to live in infamy. You get to be a part of this show. Send it in 590-590 or Instagram or Twitter, and we will get through those in the Wake and Rake hour of the show. But up next, continuing on our run of stellar guests, here's Nate. Glad to be joined by Nate Burleson, former NFL wide receiver, co-host of CBS Mornings and panelist for the NFL Today on CBS every Sunday. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning. How you doing?
We're doing well. We're really happy to be back for some Thursday night football. It's always the worst, those 2 days in between the week. Maybe it's nice for you, you get a break, but we just want football back. So we got a big one tonight, Dolphins and Bengals. I guess we'll start with the Dolphins because they've been on a roll here. Is there the way that maybe after a really tough game against Buffalo on the weekend, they might have some side effects of that grueling weather and the tough game? Is that something to consider if you're betting tonight or you're wondering the outcome?
No, I just go with the team that has the most rhythm and the most confidence, you know, regardless of, you know, who they played the previous weeks or how tough an opponent was the last time you were on the field. You just look at the Dolphins and what they're putting together. I mean, it's just one hell of a season. You know, they start off by beating Patriots and Bill Belichick, and then, you know, he beats Harbaugh with the Baltimore Ravens, and then he gets this win over McDermott, who's one of the best coaches. Oh, and that's just not to mention the Buffalo Bills, who are one of the best teams, and a lot of people have them favored to win the Super Bowl. So, right now, if I was looking at a squad that I wanted to ride with, it would be the Dolphins.
What about a wide receiver tandem to ride with? I think Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill might be the best duo in the game and certainly have helped Tua Tagovailoa take his game to the next level. Maybe not as prolific against Buffalo, but certainly something that Cincinnati has to be all over if they hope to improve to 2-2.
Yeah, I would agree with you. They're just so explosive, you know, and there's a few duos out there that you could point to. You know, I wouldn't sleep on Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen, you know, Stephon Diggs and just about anybody. But Gabe Davis comes to mind when it comes to the Bills. And there's guys across the league. Even Seattle has a couple of dudes, you know, Lockett and Metcalf. But when it comes to playmaking, explosiveness, just a pure speed aligned with the play calling, it's the perfect storm, because it's not just about how difficult Tyreek Hill or Jalen Waddle is to guard, because they are. They run some of the best routes. Tyreek creates so much separation in and out of his breaks. He can high point the ball even though he's a shorter receiver. But then you allow the play calling to do magic. And what do I mean by that? Like, they do these pre-snap alignments and movements, bunch formations. You have Tyreek running back and forth in these motions. So just imagine that if you're a DB and you want to get your hands on Tyreek at the line of scrimmage, and the call for that defensive play is for you to press him, but then he goes in motion and he hides behind a tight end or another wide receiver and then explodes off the line of scrimmage. It's almost like you're giving him a head start. I mean, for those who are familiar with the CFL, it's very similar. You're using Tyreek like that behind the line of scrimmage, which gives him so much momentum, before each play. So it's a combination of how talented they are along with the coaching staff.
On the other side of the field, we've got the Bengals, and their O-line has looked a little bit suspect, to say the least. How concerning is that when you're looking at ways to exploit this team?
Well, you got to put pressure on Joe Burrow and see if he can make the right decision. Early on in the season, that's what teams were doing. They were, one, trying to collapse that pocket, make him uncomfortable in there. And one thing that Joe Burrow has done is he's known for extending plays when he doesn't need to. He has that kind of that moxie, for a lack of a better word, that basically he will extend the play and then try to get the ball downfield to his playmakers, which in most cases, as a wide receiver, I would love that. But when you have an offensive line and it's breaking down sooner than expected and your wide receivers aren't in position, you're forcing errant throws. And that's what got him in trouble early on in the season. So the Dolphins, one thing they do is they like to blitz. And then they're going to try to get to Joe Burrow. The question is, one, can he get the ball out fast enough? Then after that, can he make the right decision? And if he is in a situation where he feels like it might be a risky throw or the window's too small, or I could be able to squeeze out of this is what could be a sack, will he decide to throw the ball away and live to play another down? You know, I was told by a coach a long time ago, sometimes it's the plays that you don't try to make that helps you win the game. And I think Joe Burrow is learning that.
Yeah, I think you beat me to it there, Nate, because, you know, this is the second year in a row where it's a different offensive line, but still major, major questions. And at some point you got to, I don't know, George Bush sort of ruined that line, but it's shame on me if you fooled me twice. And I think Burrow has to make a slight adjustment himself because he's only going to get so much time. And it seems like sometimes he buys too much of it.
Yeah, and you know, the receivers, they have to help too, and they have been. Last week they showed up big, and it seems like it was all hands on deck. But if you look at Ja'Marr Chase, for example, last year, you know, he was averaging, I think, like 18 yards per throw attempt. So the distance of the throws to Ja'Marr were almost 20 yards in distance, big plays, right? We're talking deep in cuts, deep outs, of course, the post and the goes. This year, it's around 12 yards. What does that mean for everybody? It's like, Nate, you're throwing around a lot of numbers. It's basically they're getting the ball to him sooner, and the shorts are shorter. So if you're a wide receiver, you know when it comes to the quick routes, anything under 10 yards, I'm going to have to get open earlier and be more aggressive sooner because that's what the play calling is right now for the Cincinnati Bengals offense.
We talk a lot of Bengals or a lot of Bills, rather, on the show, and rightfully so. I mean, they're the type of team that deserves to be talked about quite a bit. But they are a little banged up right now. As we mentioned, they lost Micah Hyde for the season, an integral piece of their defense. Are you feeling a little bit different about this team after week three? The loss isn't so much of a big deal, but maybe already dealing with some of these detritive aspects of the season, losing some bodies and maybe being lesser than on defense now than at least they were.
Yeah, the loss in the column, it pales in comparison to the loss of bodies, especially on the defense side of the ball. You know, they were going into that game with a couple of rookies on the back end of that defense that actually – did a pretty good job of keeping the Dolphins wide receivers in check. But, you know, the one thing I've always said is if you have injuries early, it's better to get them out of the way. And then after that, you can try to figure out the best way to, one, heal up if guys are indeed going to come back if they're temporary injuries, not guys put on IR. But then also those young players that are thrown into the flames early on in the season, those rookies thrown out there early on in the season, they'll catch the rhythm. They'll settle down middle of the season. They'll start to play better. And then they'll be on the same page, hopefully, as the veterans on that team later in the season. So, you know, when you have injuries, it's tough. But when you have veterans that can hold down the fort, starting with their quarterback and then wide receiver, Stephon Diggs, you know, you got guys like Von Miller that have been through this. And then a coach that's as sturdy as it gets. I'm not too worried. It's too early for me to panic, even if it is about guys being banged up.
We're talking to Nate Burleson from CBS Mornings, a panelist for the NFL Today on CBS. Nate, someone that's really impressed, I think, a lot of people across the football world is Trevor Lawrence this season. He seems to be having that sophomore year explosion early on, but we'll give him that so far. What's he doing different or better this season?
there's a calm. You know, when you watch Trevor Lawrence, I want you to pay attention to his helmet. And, a lot of young quarterbacks, even some inexperienced veteran quarterbacks, their helmet will bounce up and down like crazy when they're in the pocket. And for me, that was always a sign of a quarterback going through his reads too frantically and then also panicking. He's not doing that. He does have a little bit more trust in that offensive line. He does have more trust in his wide receivers. They added Christian Kirk, which was a huge pickup for the Jags. And you can see that they have a special connection so far this season. But, yeah, it's that he has this calm. And like I said before, you know, when we were talking about Joe Burrow, sometimes it's the throws that you don't make is what allows you to have the game that you want. And you see that he's not forcing those plays. But he's also showing that athleticism in that arm. When he gets outside that pocket, man, he can throw with the best of them. So, you know, it's a good thing that things are really starting to shape up for him. He's starting to see the game better, which means it starts to slow down. He has wide receivers, tight ends, and, of course, running backs that can make that big play for him and take a little pressure off of his shoulders.
We're going to see another second-year quarterback back on the field this Sunday. It was announced that Zach Wilson will be behind center again for the New York Jets, which means Joe Flacco is heading back to the bench. Do you believe there's, you know, a similar second-year bump for Wilson, assuming that we think that Trevor Lawrence is going to continue on his upward trajectory? Does Wilson have that same potential, you think?
He has the same potential for sure. We haven't seen it yet. We've seen moments. We've seen flashes. We've seen him show that big arm, make every throw in the book. Even though he's been banged up, we've seen him escape the pocket and look really, really good. Avoiding tacklers and making plays with his legs. The talent is there. For me, it's the consistency. You know, does he have that consistency that can ride out for four quarters? You know, forget about having a sophomore season, a good sophomore season. I want to see if he can just play well for four quarters. And it's either going to be one of two things. Watching the game from the sideline, a bird's eye view is going to cause him to be a much better quarterback, a quarterback that has slowed down the game because he's seeing it from the outside in. Or he's going to come back and he's going to try to force the issue and do too much because of adrenaline, maybe his own confidence and his skills. So we'll see one or the other. And I'm hoping it's the latter. I hope that he does indeed have a different type of composure in the pocket because he has some guys that he can throw the rock to. He has some playmakers. So there isn't too many excuses for him now.
Nate, where are you at with Tom Brady? I know we're bouncing around a lot of quarterbacks, but he's someone that is looking maybe a little bit old, a little bit frustrated, but still able to get close in games. Is he still have a little bit of magic or is just not enough weapons going to be the result this season?
Well, he doesn't have enough guys at his disposal, or at least the guys that we're familiar, you know, familiar with seeing next to Tom Brady. Listen, Father Time is undefeated. That's the one dude you can't beat. And he's been avoiding Father Time for 20 years. Now, I'm not saying Tom Brady looks old because he is old. So he's not going to be moving and shaking like these young quarterbacks. I mean, he left the pocket last week and everybody was going crazy because he had a long run. I just feel like the league is so much better. The defenders are so much faster. So when we have, you know, these defenses that he's facing, he doesn't look the same. Because as he ages, the league improves and catches up, and they're starting to figure out the best ways to stop Tom Brady and his offensive weapons. So unless Julian Edelman is going to leave the booth and Rob Gronkowski is coming back, and he can kind of find some magic. I don't see them making a magical run to the Super Bowl. I still think Tom Brady will be in the top 10 in quarterbacks when it comes to statistical numbers as it applies to yards and passes and touchdowns. I just don't know if that's going to equate to a Super Bowl run.
I quickly wrote off the Cowboys after week one, losing Dak Prescott, losing in the fashion they did, but now they're back-to-back wins behind Cooper Rush, maybe the defensive player of the year frontrunner and Micah Parsons. And it seems like they're having success running the ball again, going a little bit with a more simplistic approach and having a lot of success doing that. Are there teachings here for when Dak returns? Should it be a more simplified approach from Dallas anyway? And would that put him in a better position to you know, make best use of this season and have success when all their players are at their disposal?
Well, I've always thought that the best thing for the Cowboys to do is lean on the run and also use Tony Pollard a lot more. And we're starting to see that. And this is a knock against Ezekiel Elliott. He's still a beast. He still can move and shake with the best of them. And, you know, he's damn near unstoppable when you give him, you know, that ball close to the end zone or if it's third or fourth and one. He still has enough giddy up in those legs. But Tony Pollard is, I think, the biggest piece of the puzzle there. Even when Dak gets back, he's the X factor. So if you can get him more involved within this offense and using the explosive players on your team, it makes it easier for everybody. It makes it easier for CeeDee Lamb. And then, you know, the help of Michael Gallup, of course, was an issue when the season started. So they'll be just fine. And I think now leaning on the run, it's going to open up the pass game. And when Dak Prescott comes back, hopefully he can pick up where Cooper Rush left off.
Jalen Hurts has been one of the biggest stories of the NFL season so far. Of course, the Philadelphia Eagles have been a major, major part of that story as well. But Hurts is surprising many. I mean, he's a veritable MVP candidate. He might be the early front runner. He might be the front runner right now. Do you think what we're seeing is sustainable in Philadelphia? And do you think, are you surprised at all that Jalen Hurts has emerged from a, you know, lesser prospect compared to many of the quarterbacks that came out when he did? And has become a guy who can pretty much do everything on the football field.
No, I'm not surprised at all. He's a leader. And he's always been a hard worker. If you look at him in college, you look at him lifting, you look at how he talks to his teammates, you look at how guys talk about him, you knew those type of individuals were going to do everything within their power to improve. So even the little things that people were talking about last year, the accuracy and you know, the certain throws that they would love to see him make more often, more consistently, he worked on all of that, not to mention he got stronger, built more of a rapport with his teammates. They added A.J. Brown. You got Miles Sanders, who was coming off an injury over the summer. But, I mean, they have everything that they need, not to mention tight end play. So this is a team that's absolutely legit. He's taking care of the ball. He's not forcing the ball in between coverages. And on top of that, he's a beast of a runner when he takes the ball and escapes the pocket. He has, I believe, six games with two or more touchdowns, rushing touchdowns, that is. The record is 10 by Cam Newton. And Cam Newton did it in 100-plus games. And I think it was like 130 or something like that. Jalen has done this in 21 starts. So he has A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith, beast. He has Miles Sanders behind him. He's a beast. Oh, and not to mention, when Jalen leaves the pocket, he turns into a running back. They're legit, man. It's one of those teams when you face as a defense, you have to pick your poison.
Before we let you go, Nate, I've got to ask you, you know, you're famous for the toe drag swag segment on Good Morning Football. What's the best catch you've seen this season? Is it Pickens? Is it CeeDee Lamb? I mean, we've been spoiled so far. It's only week four.
Yeah, no, it's been crazy this year. That Pickens catch was nasty. just the fact that he could lean, go parallel to the ground, grab it with that right hand, and then come down with it. I think that might be the best one that I've seen so far. But every single week we're seeing these incredible catches. And there's a lot of people out there that try to blame it on the gloves. That's a lot of the old school cats from the 70s and 80s. But I just say, man, these young dudes work on this stuff. Like, that's what these old guys don't understand. And by old guys, I'm also talking to myself because I used to think, like, there's no way these dudes are making these catches. Those gloves have to be helping. But when I watch these guys practice now, I realize they're literally practicing these circus catches. And I never did that when I was younger. And I just thought to myself, this is a new generation of playmakers, and they're showing us why they're so special on a weekly basis.
Yeah, it's been incredible to watch. I'm sure we'll see a lot more this weekend. I mean, we hope at least. Nate, appreciate you joining us this morning. Thanks so much. And we're a big fan of watching you every week and every Sunday and can't wait to catch up further down the season.
Sounds good. Appreciate it. You guys have a good one.
Thursday Night Football back in action tonight. Could be part of your Wake and Rake submissions, but also maybe more important to Blue Jays fans is 1 p.m. start between the Baltimore Orioles and the Boston Red Sox. Blue Jays can clinch a playoff spot with the outcome of that game. Maybe that's part of your Wake and Rake submission. We're looking for you to send in your anchor picks, 590-590. Jess and I will shuffle through the texts. We'll select the winning anchor of our three-leg parlay, possibly four-leg parlay today as well.
Getting real aggressive.
Get them in quick because we have one more guest before we get to the Wake and Rake. 590-590, send it in. Looking to continue our hot streak. We've gone 2 for 3 this week on the Wake and Rake. How many units are we up again?
I believe it's 13 if you've been betting appropriately.
It's pretty good. That's pretty good. Let's talk to our insider, the guy you love and respect so much after the break. It's Elliot Friedman on the Fan Morning Show with Big Asterix Guy, marathon runner Justin Cuthbert, and Ailish.